Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Tulsa Symphony Orchestra returns to action this Saturday evening at 7:30 with a program that features two composers' impressions of Spanish culture. Russian Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov's Capriccio Espanol and French composer Claude Debussy's Image for Orchestra. Those will be performed along with Mozart's Posthorn Serenade. My guest today is the orchestra's pops conductor, Ron Spiegelman, who will be leading the orchestra in Saturday's Classics Concert. Spiegelman, who is a Tulsa resident, is the former music director of the Lake Placid Sinfonietta and the Springfield Symphony. He's also held conducting posts with the Buffalo Philharmonic and the Fort Worth Symphony, among others. Versatility in the orchestral world has been Spiegelman's specialty, whether leading an orchestra in pops programs here in Tulsa or accompanying a pop singer, conducting an orchestra in a live film score like Harry Potter, or a traditional classics concert. You'll be able to see him in this latter role when he leads the Tulsa Symphony this Saturday evening. Ron Spiegelman is my guest today. Ron Spiegelman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be back with you.
And it will be interesting to see you in a role that you've fulfilled many times, but not so often with the Tulsa Symphony as far as being a normal classics conductor. You do a lot of the pops performances.
That's right.
And a lot of performances in various situations for the
That's
symphony.
True. I pretty much am like, when they say the jack of all trades as a conductor, I'm trying to think of what I haven't done. I mean, it's been opera, ballet, film, theater, pop, symphonic. I mean, I've even worked with Chinese acrobats. We don't even need to go into that. But the point is that, you know, it's all the same principle where you prepare at the highest possible level you can, and you get it ready, and you put on those tails, which, by the way, is the only difference. It's like, usually for a pop show, I wear a dinner jacket, so my jacket has grown 1 foot, and now I have tails on. And so that'll be the difference. No, but truly great music. Great performing, I think, in every genre. When you look at pops artists such as James Taylor, Peter Paul and Mary, who I've worked with, there's a level there that you have to bow to and say, you know what, whether or not they're performing Gershwin or Mozart, which, funnily enough, James Taylor, when I worked with him, actually did some Gershwin and some Copland songs on this first half, you know, try to stretch himself. They're iconic artists for a reason. They're also extremely talented and brilliant. And if they had gone into the classical era, I think they'd be brilliant at that too. It's just not where they were. So I feel very fortunate that I've seen all sides of this. I feel as though doing a lot of pops actually helps with the classical, because you can kind of see a much more sort of human aspect to it.
Well, this program has an interesting aspect to it. It's kind of a mixed bag internationally. You have French music, you have Russian music, but really they're both Spanish music.
Right, Spanish music.
Or interpretations of Spanish music.
That's absolutely correct. And what's interesting is that the approaches of Rimsky-Korsakov and the Capriccio Espanol, which interestingly has a very coincidental relationship with Debussy and his piece Image, in that Debussy went to that famous fair where he learned about the gamelan and the Eastern influences of the instruments, which is the same fair that Rimsky-Korsakov premiered Capriccio Espanol.
So, is that the Seville Fair?
Yeah. And so it was 1889, somewhere in there. And so it's kind of interesting how that they cross paths that way, but they could not be more different in their approaches to the genre of paying tribute, in a sense, to Spain. Now, with the Debussy, it's the middle movement, Iberia, which is the middle three movements of the piece. In bare general terms, and I said this to the orchestra in our rehearsals. I said, you know, the way you approach Rimsky-Korsakov, it's hard-edged. It's a little bit jagged at times. The color is a splash. So Debussy is warm, soft edges, smooth, and it's a wash of color. At the same time, what I love about Debussy is that he actually writes a direction to the violins at one point, which is simply says rude. Or I guess in the French, rude, if it sounds a little more fancy. But in fact, if the French direct translation is coarse. So he will at times ask for a hard edge. But the point is that that's the only time you give it. Otherwise, it's much more of a homogenized and blended sound where, you know, not to be too cliche, but that idea of an impressionistic painting where the colors kind of run into each other. That's the same idea in terms of its musical output, whereas Rimsky-Korsakov is much more direct and structured and much easier to decompress as a listener and as a musician.
When we think of Debussy saying rude, it's a very different rude than perhaps any other culture.
Oh, very much so. It's much slapping you with a silk glove or something. I don't know. But it's true that he was trying very much to evoke sort of a feeling of Spain. And with the other two movements, you have Gigue, which is actually like an Irish jig. He actually quotes a reel, an English reel. And then the Ronde de Printemps, which is another quote of a folk song, but more about, you know, the birth of spring, not the rite of spring, but the birth of spring. And it's very kind of, takes a while, it's very fragmented, and then it finally comes together. So Debussy is much more, I wouldn't say the word is esoteric. He's much more wanting people to be enveloped by what is going on and to feel what is happening. Even the second movement, which is all about fragrance of the night. The idea of the concept, this music actually evokes a smell or a fragrance. So that's definitely different to Rimsky-Korsakov, which is like dance to this, pretty much.
Well, the Image is such an interesting piece because it's almost like a symphony in a way, except it's not really. And you have these two outer movements, and then this middle movement has three movements within itself.
Right.
And it's like a triptych within a triptych.
It is a triptych within a triptych. And what's fascinating to me is that we're doing the complete Image. You will often see orchestras do Iberia as an opening work to a performance. It's about 17 minutes on its own, those three movements. But the whole work is 35 to 40 minutes of just glorious and beautiful French music. But you're right, the relationships between the music movements are really not there at all, except that he decided to put them together. In fact, I was, when I did my research and I was looking up, actually to get a little tiny bit geeky, I was like, you know, there's lots of editions of the piece. Let's look and see if there's errors in between, just so I can get an idea of my score and if it's a corrected version. And so I looked on the New York Philharmonic's website because they list and they have sheets of this stuff. And then I noticed that there was an early performance in 1907 of Ronde de Printemps, which is the last movement, and it was Gustav Mahler conducting the New York Philharmonic. Yeah. So this music sort of crosses a lot of boundaries in terms of musical style, that if Mahler himself was captivated by this music enough to want to perform it. Of course, he was always a voracious reader and somebody who wanted to learn everything. And so it's no surprise that he would want to do it, but it was surprising to actually see it there on paper that it was in a program that he conducted.
Right. And so early too, just a
very
few years.
Early.
Yeah. And what's always interesting about Debussy is you have the Image piano pieces.
Right.
And I guess originally when he started writing the Image, which would eventually be for orchestra, he was singing piano, and then he said, no, I want to do it for orchestra.
Right. He actually started as a piano single piano. Then he went to two pianos because he could tell he wanted to do more with the harmony. And then he was like, you know what? That's not going to work either. So then he did the ultimate palette, which is an orchestra. Now, there's a very interesting recording with Leonard Bernstein, a live recording. It's not my favorite recording. I'll be honest, my favorite recording of the work, and I've listened to many, many and live versions, I always find myself thinking about what Pierre Boulez does with the piece, which is slightly too logical, but at the same time, it's so well balanced that you get the sense that you really heard what Debussy was looking for. Whereas Bernstein takes a lot of liberties, especially with the order of the movements, because Bernstein, if it was nothing else, was a showman. Now, I happen to be a huge admirer of his, and I did get to meet him once, and I did.
You're a bit of a showman yourself.
You think so?
I think so.
Well, I'll try to tone it down a little. but he was to the point where he wanted the piece to end at its most voracious point, which Iberia ends with this incredible flourish, ironically, on trombone. And so he changed the order of the movements. He decided to do Gigue, first movement, then Ronde de Printemps as the second movement. And then he ended with Iberia. There's a live performance with the Orchestra of St. Cecilia, Italy, and that's how he did it for that performance. I don't know if he always did it that way, but it makes sense to do that, except for the fact that that's not how it was published. So I figured, no, let's do the version that Debussy was planning. Now, fragmented for sure, 1905 to 1912 is when he wrote the work. So he didn't write it all in one sitting. It's not like a symphony. But when you do the piece, you get a sense that you've heard a symphony because of the fact that there are five movements.
Right. So, well, let's hear a little bit of that Pierre Boulez recording. Let's hear from Iberia. What would you like to hear?
The final movement is absolutely spectacular. The movement about the morning of the festival.
All right. Let's hear music. This is Pierre Boulez with the Cleveland Orchestra, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra Saturday evening at 7:30, the music of Claude Debussy. That's musical Claude Debussy from his Image for Orchestra, the final section of the middle movement, which is in itself, it's sort of like a puzzle there. It's the final movement of the second movement, Iberia, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. My guest today is Ron Spiegelman, who's the Pops conductor of the Tulsa Symphony, but he'll be leading the orchestra in a classics concert this Saturday. And again, the concert opens with a very different sort of Spanish flavor, the Rimsky-Korsakov Capriccio Espanol. You said this is hard-edged. And of course, a lot of critics say it's a beautiful orchestration, and Rimsky-Korsakov always had a problem with that. He said, it's a beautiful composition.
Right. People think of it as a light classics work. Certainly when you say that to a musician, they'll tell you it is one of the most fiendishly difficult things to play, especially if you're the clarinet player, and of course we have a magnificent clarinetist, David Carter. And then of course there are other solos with flute and violin and harp, cello. But in a sense, it is a light work, and it is based on his actual personal experience being in the Navy, and he actually got to port in Spain, and he was captivated, as you would be. And as a young man, what I love about Rimsky-Korsakov is he kind of founded modern orchestration in a lot of ways. And yet he himself didn't really ever study formally like other composers would, and yet he became a teacher. He could actually understand what he was doing and how to do it. And in a sense, he was self-taught. But what's great about Rimsky-Korsakov is that you get the sense that it is the birth of the orchestra sort of in full color. It's almost like when they used to do those old black and white films, they would hand color them sometimes, sepia tones and reds. And I remember doing Ben-Hur, the original 1926 Ben-Hur, and there were certain frames that were colored, but they were hand colored. And so you got the sense that when Rimsky-Korsakov came along, he was able to just write in full color. I hearken it to that wonderful scene in Wizard of Oz where the house has landed and she opens that door, and then suddenly this colorful world emerges. And that's, in my opinion, even though they look totally different, Judy Garland, Rimsky-Korsakov, you can't ever mistake them, but it's that scene that I look at when I hear something like Capriccio Espanol. It's like it just bursts forth with this incredible, you know, splash of color.
It's almost Hollywood in a way.
Yeah, in a lot of ways it is, because he's not subtle at all. It's like, oh yeah, there are the castanets. Now, there are castanets in Image as well, but it's not done in the same way. It's part of the orchestration, whereas this is like, here they are. And the rhythms, the actual melodies, everything about it. But it's tremendously exciting work. And the second movement, Alborado, is absolutely beautiful. The melody is really, I mean, it's Spanish, but it's really Russian. You can tell it's a Russian writing this, because there's so much depth and intensity to it. So I've done the work many, many times. It's one of my favorite pieces to conduct. It has a fantastic ending. And I also love the fact that it's a mini concerto for orchestra. The fact that he features all the sections. You have the brass doing the fanfare. You have the harp solo, the violin solo, the clarinet solo, the cello solo. So you get almost in 15 minutes a mini concerto for orchestra. So I actually think it's a great piece for children's concerts as well. Plus the fact that he actually really, in a sense, revolutionized the percussion section because he really uses like the cymbals, snare drum. He has a way to use that as a color rather than a reinforcement.
Right.
Except when you get to the castanets. That's just simply like, we're in Spain. I just wanted to let you know.
Well, why don't we hear a little bit of the Capriccio Espanol, that variation movement.
Yes, the Variazioni. I mentioned El Mirando. That's the third movement. But the Variazioni is just absolutely beautiful. The way he opens with the French horns and then has the violins playing all down bows at one point where it's just this big, deep, burgundy, rich sound. I just absolutely love it.
Right. Here's music from Capriccio Espanol by Rimsky-Korsakov. That's music by Rimsky-Korsakov, which will be performed by the Tulsa Symphony Orchestra with my guest today, Ron Spiegelman, who will be leading the orchestra Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall. So I have to ask you, you're a good student of music. What is the deal with composers from every other culture but Spain wanting to do Spanish music? You know, they're Italians, they're French, they're Russians.
Yeah, which of course the opera's going to do. That's actually true. It's one of those things where it's a moment where they get captivated by the color and the festiveness, and it immediately spurs them into thinking of something to write for it. And yet, of course, there are great Spanish composers. I'm thinking, of course, of Manuel de Falla, that goes more into the folklore of the country more than just the color. It goes beyond that. But I love that composers will be captivated by a culture, but it does seem to be Spain as the one that they go for
and, you know,
the most.
In the 19th century, Spain was a backwater. It was like nobody wanted to go. people wanted to go to Spain, I suppose, for the rusticness of it.
That's probably it. And, you know, whenever there was some kind of dance and the rhythms of the fandango and all the great dances, it lends itself well to like, ooh, I could write a piece that with that rhythm. And so the rhythm, I think, is partly what's captivating. The rhythm of the people and, of course, the rhythm of the dances and themselves. And then, of course, you have the violin tradition. You have some musical traditions and, of course, the percussiveness of the castanets. And I think that, I don't know, it's very visceral more than anything else, I would say. There's nothing esoteric about that thing, which is that rhythmic intensity of that country and the people and the music.
Of course, the other music that was captivating composers at the same time was the music of the Roma, you know, the gypsies.
That's right, and especially you think about Hungarian dances of Brahms. You know, it's like, again, it's by the campfire, it's the dancing, it's the violin playing, and it's like, okay, I can write this. I can write something with this, you know. And I think that it's almost like it's a germ of an idea. It's like, it's an earworm. It's like the oldest earworm there is, in a sense, that it's like, oh, wow, I'll never forget that rhythm. And, you know, Copland went a little further. He went to Mexico and to Cuba. And when he went to Cuba, that was a whole different thing where he was fascinated by the fact that the rhythms were just a little bit off at times. But they could understand them. So he wrote the Danzón Cubano, which is fantastic. And then, of course, Gershwin wrote the Cuban Overture. So it's that same kind of a thing. It's all to do with the rhythmic intensity and the color.
Well, for something completely different,
oh, yeah,
your other work is utterly different. And that is the Mozart Serenade No. 9, the serenade known as the Posthorn.
Right.
Will we have a posthorn in this?
Okay, newsflash. So the K320 Symphony, the Posthorn Symphony, is three movements.
Yeah.
It's the first movement, then the Andantino, and then the finale. The posthorn movement is the second minuet.
Uh-huh.
And I pleaded and said, you know, it's five more minutes. Why don't we just put in that movement? And there was a reason I said that. Well, two reasons. One, it's the post-horn serenade. Gotta have the post-horn. I mean, as this, you know what I'm saying? It's like if Willie Nelson did a concert and said, you know, I'm tired of On the Road Again. It's like, no, 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 no. You may be tired of that. We need to hear that. And it's like, no, you gotta kind of have to, in my opinion, have the one element of the piece that that it's named for. I mean, when you do the whole serenade, it's 45 minutes.
Yes, it is.
We're doing probably half of that.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, why don't we just put that movement in? It's a fantastic movement. Also has a piccolo solo. And so that's what we're doing. We're going to put in the second minuet.
All
no
right.
extra charge. It's included with
the
ticket price.
So you're actually doing the version known as the symphony with the extra minuet.
With the extra minuet. Now, there is another reason, and that is that Mozart was famous. And this is an interesting time of his life. If there was ever a slow time in his symphonic output, it was when he wrote this, because between Symphony 30 and 31, a lot of time passed. When I say a lot of time, he died
for Mozart.
But he wrote, I think, five serenades, so for different occasions. So this serenade is particularly, it looks like it's for a graduation ceremony, which I think is fascinating. And yet he marketed the symphony out of this and separate movements. And so people could perform different fragments of this work. He didn't have a problem with that. So since he didn't have a problem with that, I don't think anybody should have a problem with, like, well, why don't we just add the minuet, you know? It actually works even better because a symphony normally has four movements. So now we're giving it its fourth movement. And I feel bad for Rob Katz, who wrote the program notes, who said, we're not playing this movement tonight in the program. So I'll mention to the audience how we've added it in. And so literally it's just a moment in the third movement where it's just these octave leaps in the what was a post horn, which is a hunting horn, basically. Of course, we don't have one of those. So
It's sort of like a hunting bugle, if you
right.
will.
Yeah. So Tim McFadden will play it on a D trumpet, but he has a post horn mouthpiece, so it gives it a more mellow tone. And we rehearsed it last night, and it was great. It's really great to hear. As a trumpet player myself, I played the movement, and so it's a wonderful thing to be able to do. So yeah, the piece itself, it's really hard to judge Mozart in a sense, because let's just say that all he wrote were his serenades. We'd still think of him as a genius. But this is definitely not Symphony 40 or 41. This is not that kind of piece where it's extremely developed, thought out. There's no double fugue. There's no sort of moving of the needle in music history with this piece. What you have, though, is somebody at the height of his powers who, in my opinion, it was impossible for him to write anything less than wonderful. And so even though, in a sense, if you go back to the idea of pops, this is kind of a pops piece for Mozart, because it was written for a ceremony. It wasn't really necessarily written to be
in a concert hall at all.
Right. Just like his divertimenti were written for parties.
Right.
You know, people would be having their asparagus, bacon wrap, shrimp, whatever, while they were some group in the corner was playing a piece by Mozart. But now when you hear them and they're brought out into the concert hall, you think, wow, this is worthy of that kind of experience.
A lot of work for a ceremony.
Absolutely. I can't imagine the musicians going, oh, Mozart's writing this one? Oh, my gosh. We can't just get together in the morning of, folks. We're going to have to get together the day before on this one. So, you know, this isn't Pachelbel's Canon where you can just whip it out and go. This is some complex music. There's, interestingly enough, with Mozart, there's a lot of additions and a lot of different articulations. And so I look at it as, you know, when you give it the full treatment, it's a magnificent work, and you remember it. And what there is one unique aspect to it that I think is almost unique to the serenade that you almost never hear in symphonies. The introduction, which he does like a symphonic introduction to his first movements, slow introduction. Usually once that is over in a symphony, it's finished. It's gone. You go into the exposition and then to the development, recap, all of that, coda, and it's over. But you never hear the introduction again. Now, in Magic Flute, you do it. The Magic Flute Overture, he brings it in. In this piece, he brings it in. But here's what he does, which I think maybe does move the needle a bit. He brings back the introduction, which is a slow introduction. He brings it in the fast tempo in the middle of the first movement. But he halves the time. So it sounds like it's the beginning, even though it's in a new tempo, which I think is remarkable. So he used the concept of stretching the rhythm to make it appear like we're going back to the beginning, but he doesn't. It's still going fast.
It's almost like he's giving his musicians an inside joke.
It might be in a sense. Yeah. Again, he probably wrote this thinking, well, who's going to listen to this? Just going to walk in and they're going to get their cap and gown, whatever they did back then. And so, you know, he was in a sense having fun with this, but when you hear it and you really listen to it, it's almost like he can't help himself but be the genius he is.
So I have to ask you about the posthorn itself. Do you think this was a gimmick? Because a posthorn was a real thing back then. It was right. The postman came to your street. He would blow his horn so you knew that the mail was coming.
I think that might have been a signal for the fact that these certificates of graduation were being delivered to the students.
Maybe so.
That's the way I feel about it, is that that was almost like it's a signal horn to say your certificate has arrived. And so I wonder. I mean, you can only wonder about this. Right. But there had to be something there with that. The other aspect of Mozart, which I've looked into before, is that he would, like, for instance, when he wrote his clarinet pieces, they were for one person. You know, he wrote them for a clarinetist.
Horn soloist in the horn concertos.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wonder if this was a similar thing, where he knew he would have this orchestra and there was this guy that delivered mail and he had a post horn. So, well, let's let him play something. This reminds me of my favorite story ever, which was when Barber was writing Summer of 1917, Knoxville, that beautiful piece for soprano and orchestra. He was asked to write a percussion part because there was somebody on the faculty who wanted to play in the work. And so he did. One triangle note. That's it. As if to say, well, you did ask for a part. I gave you a part. Hope he doesn't miss it. Because that's it. And it's actually a beautiful moment when it comes in. But at the same time, I have to think that it was just the same thing. It was just a little joke. It's like, oh, you have somebody that plays poster? All right, I'll write him something. And he's in 30 seconds of a 45-minute work.
You'll have to listen in the minuet, in the edition that the TSO will be playing Saturday night. Music by Mozart, Rimsky-Korsakov, and Debussy at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center. Ron, we look forward to a great performance. Thanks for joining us.
Thrilled to join you again and hope to see everybody there. I think everybody will enjoy the performance very much. Hearing the orchestra play in three very different styles. That's what I love about TSO. They've really grown in their ability to be able to do that. So it's going to be an exciting performance.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Tulsa Symphony Orchestra Pops conductor Ron Spiegelman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll lead the TSO in their Classics program this Saturday evening at 7:30 at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center's Chapman Music Hall in a performance of music by Rimsky-Korsakov, Debussy, and Mozart. For information on the program, visit tulsasymphony.org. Well, we're going to leave you with that famous posthorn solo from the Mozart piece here on Studio Tulsa. Our program is produced by Scott Gregory. I'm Rich Fisher. Thank you for listening.